Marnie didn't seem to mind sleeping in the cell. At least, once we promised her we'd make sure her mare, which she calls Tydea, was safe. Then she simply curled up on the small bench in the corner, and that is how I find her this morning when I return to the office. Since we don't know what else to do with her, all four of us decide to bring Marnie with us to the diner. We tie her horse to Moon, and she steadily rides behind me. Since she's so small, we assume she's easy to catch without control over her horse and forgo the cuffs. A leap of faith on our part that we might come to regret, but Marnie has been a model prisoner thus far. On our way to the center of town, we instruct her to bathe in the river. She looks confused, but complies. As our prisoner, she's apparently eager enough to take orders. Scully and I stand at the riverbank to make sure she doesn't try to swim away. But Marnie's eyes stay glued to Tydea, and we realize that she isn't going anywhere without her horse. When she comes back ashore, her hair is shiny, and she looks a shade lighter than when she first entered the water. We hand her a cloth to dry herself with, which she does quickly in the cold air. Then she dresses, and in one fluid motion, sprints over to her horse and mounts it. When we walk into the diner, we draw some interested looks. But the four of us, Scully, Jacob, Colin, and myself, ignore them. Marnie, on the other hand, stares right back. Our table draws even more looks when, after Kaylee places the plate of berries and square of fish before Marnie, she doesn't bother using her hands to eat. Instead, she lifts the plate to her face and lets the berries and then the square of fish slide right into her mouth.
"Good Gara,"
Colin whispers as we all stare at her, as she loudly chews and slurps. When she puts the plate back down, Marnie doesn't seem to notice that everyone is staring at her and smiles a sated, sleepy smile. Once the astonished amusement wears off, the diner resumes its low-level chatter.
"We need to figure out how old Rainier's cooking pot ended up at Sid's house," I say quietly. Abe is back in the diner. His leg is still bandaged, but with the help of some makeshift crutches and his daughter, he's able to get around again.
"If old Rainier wasn't the real target, but Abe was."
Colin nods towards the counter where Abe and Della are silently eating their breakfast.
"Then we have to figure out what Abe and Sid had in common that made them both a target."
"Well, according to her, Sid was planning on leaving the outpost to head up north to find some mythical land of food." I look over at Marnie, who is unabashedly staring at each person in the diner, one by one, like she's going to be tested on their appearance once we leave.
"Kanda,"
she says, without breaking eye contact with an increasingly uncomfortable James.
"Right, this mythical food land called Kanda."
I rub my face and take another sip from my brew to wake myself up. Prudence was coughing all night. The cooing sounds Rita was making didn't seem to help as much as the night before, which is making me nervous. She's getting a lot sicker fast, I think.
"Maybe Abe and Della are trying to make a break for it, too,"
Jacob whispers in between his teeth.
"And maybe someone is trying to stop them."
"Well, if so, it worked," I say. "I mean, look at Abe's leg. He's not going anywhere anytime soon."
"Who's that?"
Marnie has focused in on Perry.
"I like him."
"That's one of the farmers." I tried to get our attention back to the case at hand. We need to talk to Abe. We need to get him to talk. And if that doesn't work, we need to figure out whose boots those are.
"I'm going to talk to Perry now,"
Marnie says and stands up.
"What? No, you're not. You're our prisoner for Gara's sake."
I pull at her arm, but she shakes me off and makes her way over to the farmer's table with long strides for someone so little, and I'm starting to reconsider the handcuffs.
"Oh my Gara, this woman!"
I groan and stand to follow her, but Colin grabs my arm. I shoot him a look.
"Just maybe let him have a taste of his own annoyance."
I look over and realize the entire diner is now again staring at Marnie, who is standing across the table from Perry. She's leaned over the table, trying to talk to him in her strange accent.
I'm Marnie from the Plateaus,
I can hear her say.
I like you.
Well, at least she's learned to introduce herself.
Perry looks terrified. He glances over at Della, who is sitting at the counter, as if he expects her to put a stop to this, to claim him as her own and save him from this tiny, wild woman. But Della just grins at him and pops a berry in her mouth and says nothing.
Your name is Perry,
Marnie says, and I can hear her clearly now as the entire diner has gone dead silent.
Yes,
Perry says.
Would you like to meet after I am released?
Marnie rounds the table and pushes James out of his chair with her behind.
I think you could come with me back to the Plateaus if you want to.
I don't want to,
Perry says and looks around for anyone to help him.
You will,
Marnie says with confidence.
And if not, I will just take you.
Okay, now she's threatening abduction. I make my way over to Marnie and push my way past James, who looks highly amused, and grab her by the arm. Okay, let's go. You've had your fun.
I'll see you soon,
Marnie says over her shoulder to Perry as I guide her back to our table. His eyes widen, and he quickly gathers himself to leave.
I think it's best we go now,
he tells the other farmers, but they just grin and don't move. While the four of us finish our meal, we watch Marnie watching Perry, and we watch Perry trying to avoid her watching him.
I like you,
Jacob says to Marnie, an amused grin on his face.
Sorry, I like Perry,
Marnie replies, and she gives Jacob a pitying look. Jacob giggles, a sound that I am not sure I've ever heard in my life. Well, I'm glad we're all having fun with this. Now can we please focus on catching the killer? I'm running low on patience, and Jacob shrugs.
Sorry.
Sid was a target. Abe might be a target. And the only thing we have that ties them together is a cooking pot and strange boot prints, I say.
And all of that is quite tenuous,
Colin adds. Yes, I sigh. Maybe we just need to take one day to regroup. Maybe this will start to make more sense when we take a step back. No one says anything. We're all tired. We could all use a day off. We all lean back in our chairs a little bit. Some of the people in the diner finish their breakfast and leave. We watch lazily as they go. We wave to Tori and her daughter, Pyla, and Clarice as they get up and make their way outside into the cold morning.
In the Plateaus, we give the one we want to keep a woven basket filled with red brush flowers,
Marnie says dreamily.
Where does one find red brush flowers this time of year around here?
You really don't, I tell her. Maybe some dried leaves would do the trick?
No, it has to be the flowers.
She seems disappointed. Finally, the farmers get up and go, and just as soon as they've left the diner, Marnie seems to forget about Perry.
You give baskets to people you want to keep?
Jacob asks her.
I have 5 beloveds back home,
Marnie says, and then her eyes cloud over and she stares at the table.
Right,
Jacob says. I can tell he wants to ask her more about this arrangement, but she's so sad all of a sudden that he doesn't dare to. We all stare down at our empty plates, and I can't help but feel bad for her, this tiny woman, so far from home, so alone, and now captured. From somewhere outside, we can hear a loud bang. Watch her, I tell Jacob, and Colin and I scramble towards the door.
Someone's shooting something,
Colin grunts as we tear out of the diner.
And the only 4 people in this outpost with guns were at that table.
Do you know where it came from? I ask one of the worshippers outside in the street. The entire group of them has stopped praying. They all stare up the street, facing north, the same direction as my own hut. The man I've asked doesn't say anything but points in that direction. Then he falls to his knees and starts praying. They all do. One by one, as we run through the crowd, they bow and pray and sing like their lives depend on it.
They're not making this easier.
Colin sounds exasperated as we dodge the devout crouching down as we run among them. They're really not, I say as I'm forced to leap over someone who has dropped down to the ground right before me. Another shot rings out, and the entire crowd ducks down, maybe for prayer or for cover.
That was a lot closer.
Colin pants, running beside me. We leave the center of the outpost behind us and keep running north down the trail. At the end of the road, right before the trail disappears into the woods, we can see a body splayed out, arms and legs flung out like an X.
O'Gara, who is it?
Colin pants and looks at me.
I don't know.
I pant back and then start running as fast as I can. Clarice is alive when we get to her, but barely. One shot to the leg, and the other bullet has taken off part of the back of her head. There's a trail of blood. She tried to run.
Oh my God, she's still breathing.
I look at Colin, who looks green around the gills.
Clarice!
I rub her sternum.
Can you hear me?
Her eyes shift ever so slightly towards me, but her mouth, agape, doesn't move to form words.
Shit!
I hiss. Shit, shit, shit! I stop shaking her and lean back, sitting in the frozen mud beside her.
We'll have to bring her back to the station and let her son and his family know.
Colin has turned around and is breathing in deeply, staring at the trees in the woods.
She's dead now?
He inhales in a quick gasp, and for a moment, I think he's going to lose his breakfast like he did when we found Sid.
Yes, she's dead.
I lean forward and make sure that she isn't still breathing. Whoever got her shot her in the leg first. Colin turns around and glances down at Clarice.
And then in the head. But there was time in between.
There was.
Do you think he was trying to get something out of her?
Maybe. I check Clarice's pockets. They're all empty.
Poor Clarice.
Colin crouches down next to me.
Who would want to hurt old Clarice?
That, I say, looking towards the woods, is the question. A branch cracks in the brush just a few feet away from us. Colin and I don't move. Don't let on that we've heard it. For all we know, it could be a deer or a bird looking for worms in the mud. But the ground is frozen. The deer have started to stay closer to home as winter nears, and while Colin and I keep talking to each other, both of us casually unlatch our holsters.
Best we head back,
Colin says and puts his hands on his hips, making a point of facing back down the road towards the diner.
Yeah, we need to get the horses up here and move the body, though.
I stand up from beside Clarice and face Colin, which allows me to face towards the woods. Someone is standing there, just behind the brush. A tall figure, concealed, but not well enough. His clothing isn't brown or white or gold. He doesn't match the ground, the frost, or the turning leaves. He's not from here, or he'd know how to dress to hide in the forest.
Maybe we should just wait for the others to bring the horses over. Would make it easier than having to make two trips.
I can hear the pitter-patter of hooves coming closer from behind. I am forced to face the others as they ride up, or the man would have known I've made him.
O'Gara.
Jacob slides off his horse and starts running towards Clarice. Colin walks towards him and grabs him by the arm.
She's dead, Jacob,
he says, still gripping his arm.
Someone shot her.
I see the slight squeeze he gives Jacob as he says, someone, and Jacob instantly understands his younger brother.
Poor Clarice,
Jacob says and puts his hands on his hips, unlatching his gun, making a point of not looking up. Another cracking sound from the woods. It's so loud this time that we can't pretend we haven't heard it, and neither can the figure standing in the brush watching us. The cracking is followed by a dozen more as the figure gives up on hiding and makes a run for it.
God damn it.
Colin hisses and starts towards Trapper, but Trapper is the horse furthest away. I look up at Marnie, who's almost right beside me, and whose horse is still tied to Moon's saddle. Hesitation plays across her face. The only other person still on horseback is Scully, and her mare, while fairly strong, is no match to Marnie's horse, nor to Moon when it comes to speed. If Marnie wants to run, this is her chance. But instead, she takes one quick look down at Clarice, a woman she studied intensely at the diner just a few moments ago. Then she makes a clicking sound with her tongue and covers the few feet in between us, Moon and Toe. I hop onto my horse, and together Marnie and I ride down the path into the forest. The damp coolness of the woods enshrouds us as we gallop after the disappearing figure ahead. After a moment of hesitation, I loosen the rope between Marnie's horse and Moon's saddle and throw it over my shoulder to allow Moon to gallop at full speed. The horse's hooves thunder beneath us as we chase the killer through the woods. The path is well worn, and Marnie pulls ahead of me, her giant horse whinnies with excitement. The man comes into focus ahead of us. I don't want to kill him. I want answers. Marnie looks back over her shoulder, and I hold up the rope, still dangling over mine. She nods and pulls to the left of the path, while I pull to the right. Marnie slows, and I catch up, so we're riding in parallel along the edges of the trail. The man ahead of us is a fast runner, but he's no match. When we pass by him, I can see that his green cloth shirt is drenched in sweat, despite the cold. And just as I notice this, I recognize him. Marnie and I slow our horses to stay exactly 2 feet ahead of the man, who is looking from her to me and back, confused more than anything. Then, in one quick motion, I throw the end of the rope to Marnie, who leans over the neck of her horse and deftly catches it while hanging off the horse's shoulder. The man realizes what we are trying to do and tries to stop. But he's running too fast, and the rope tenses against his chest before he can do anything. He bounces against it and topples sideways and onto the ground. Marnie and I stop short and get off our horses.
Why did he hurt your friend?
Marnie asks as we walk over to him.
I have no idea,
I say as we walk up to him, but I intend to find out. When we get closer, we can see that the man is holding his right leg and grunts quietly, with his head bent towards his chest.
Who are you, really?
I demand, but he doesn't look up at me. Instead, he smiles, his chin still tucked down, giving him an awful grimace.
You know who I am. I'm Sid's cousin Hal. Don't you remember me?
And I'm Gara herself. I reply and unlatch my handcuffs, then gruffly cuff the man's arms behind his back. Blood starts to leak through the green fabric of his pants at the knee, but I ignore it. Until he talks, he's not getting my help. Where's the gun? I demand after searching him as we walk back towards Clarice and the others. Our horses trot behind us dutifully. The man says nothing. I consider kicking him in the knee, but figure I'll save that for later.
Oh my Gara, it's the guy from the diner? Sid's cousin?
Colin is staring at us, wide-eyed, as he rides up to meet us halfway.
Sorry I couldn't get to Trapper fast enough.
He strokes the horse's neck.
But it looks like I didn't need to.
He looks at Marnie with a sideways glance, reassessing her.
You know, our prisoners don't usually help us with the crime solving,
he says.
I'm a good prisoner,
Marnie replies without irony. The man's neck tenses as he tries to get a better look at Marnie, his interest piqued. I give Colin a warning look and push him ahead of me.
Eyes on the road.
I hiss at the man in his green outfit, and his hair falls over his eyes as he complies. When we get back to Jacob and Scully, they have already taken Clarice and have laid her across Jacob's horse tender saddle. I'm grateful for it. I've already had 2 bodies slung over Moon's back in recent memory. Using the rope, I secure our newest prisoner and force him onto the saddle behind me. Even while we ride back to the law office, he doesn't say a word. And even though we chased him through the forest on horseback, he is not out of breath. We get back to the law office. Jacob and Scully carry Clarice downstairs, and they shuffle slowly, the bodies stretched limply between them. Colin holds the bulb between his teeth while simultaneously churning the lek box. I pray to Gara he doesn't get electrocuted. Meanwhile, I take the handcuffed man in green into my office and sit him down across from me. He stares down at my desk. I didn't find anything in his pockets, so getting him to talk is the only way I'm going to get information.
Why did you shoot Clarice?
I ask, my voice calm. Nothing. I walk around the desk and rotate the chair 90 degrees so he's facing me. I stare into his watery blue eyes and grab the front tuft of his hair. I pull back, forcing his chin up.
Why did you kill Clarice?
I ask him again, my voice even. The rage comes in waves now. The gravity of what this man has done is sinking in. Prudence's oldest friend is dead. I keep pulling his hair back, willing to scalp him for answers. I grip my teeth and get closer to the man, holding him as if I were about to kiss him or kill him. He smells strangely sweet in the middle of winter, like flowers, and for a moment I'm distracted. As if he can sense this, the man pushes his head forward. Some of his hair comes loose in my hand, and I'm still holding it as he headbutts me in the chest. I stumble back against the wall, but catch myself and jump back up. The man is striding towards the door, working away at the rope with a small square knife of some sort. I don't know how I missed it during my search, but some of the rope strands are already breaking apart, flying off into random directions. I spin around and kick the man in the back, and he falls forward. I can hear the sound his teeth make as they hit the wooden door. He doesn't stop. He tries the handle, but it's locked. I'm not an idiot. I almost laugh, but my back hurts from where he threw me against the wall. He turns to face me. He's no longer demure. He's furious.
You little bitch.
He snarls at me and lunges. But his wrists are still cuffed, and some of the rope is still wrapped around his shoulders and his chest. Head first, he comes at me, and without thinking, I pull my weapon and butt him with it, right between the eyes. The man slumps to the ground, and I stare down at him. Believe it or not, this is not what I intended. I tell him, but he just groans. I tighten the rope's ends back together. Then I search the floor, and I find the square little knife by the door. It is shorter than my pinky finger and only twice as wide. It's incredibly sharp at two of its edges, and I place it into one of my desk drawers for evidence. Then I drag the man out into the main office, where Scully, Jacob, and Colin stare at me. He came at me, is all I say, and Colin helps me drag the man into the holding cell where Marnie is sitting on the bench in the back.
Please lock me up somewhere else.
She looks at me, terrified.
We don't really have anywhere else.
I look around the office.
He kills other people,
Marnie says, matter of fact. She stands up from the bench and starts edging towards me along the wall.
Please, I helped you catch him. He'll kill me for sure.
I turn to look at my deputies.
She's not wrong, Sheriff. She did help, and he probably will try to kill her for it,
Jacob says, and I begrudgingly hold the door open a little further to let Marnie slide by me and into the main office. The man is still lying on the floor, groaning.
What are we going to do with her?
I'm right here, you know that? You can see me.
Marnie has sat down at Colin's desk, but he doesn't seem to mind.
Honestly, I think we should just let her go,
Scully says out of nowhere.
You what?
I ask.
I don't think she's the killer, and if we give her the last two berry parcels, she'll head home anyway. It's true,
Marnie says, inspecting a stack of paper on Colin's desk, like she's never seen paper before.
I need to bring food to my home. Since we cannot go to Canada without Sid's assistance, I need to bring what I can, or they will likely starve.
How many of you are there, anyway?
Jacob asks, curious as ever.
There are about 300 of us on the entire plateau.
That's it?
Jacob looks shocked.
You have a lot more people. I saw them all today in the eating house and outside of it. You have so many strange things.
Marnie holds up the key that locks the drawers of Colin's desk.
What is this strange little metal stick? Is it to poke tiny fires with?
This makes her laugh, and for a while we just watch Marnie as she giggles to herself while rifling through the things strewn across Colin's desk. She looks pretty harmless now, I suppose.
She's always been harmless, Scully says.
She looks like she wants to tell me something.
What is it?
I look at her, and she just points down to the man in the cell, lying on his side. He stopped growing.
What?
I whisper, and Scully points at her shoes and back at the man. When I look back towards the cell, the man lying there on the ground, his feet facing us, I almost forget to breathe.
His boots, I whisper. He's wearing the boots with the square patterned soles.
Scully nods and then looks over at Marnie.
She isn't the one we need to be worried about.
As she says this, Marnie has discovered a pen and has started drawing circles all over her arms. So he was the one who tried to shoot Abe. I look over at the man. He stopped moving completely now, and if his chest wasn't moving ever so slightly, I'd worry he was dead.
We know he shot Clarice, Colin says.
But what do Abe and Clarice have in common that would make this guy want to shoot them both? I shrug my arms across my chest and stare at him. But he's out cold, and I don't think we're getting any more answers out of him today. We busy ourselves logging the remaining items Scully packed at Sid's. The process is slowed some by Marnie running over any time someone pulls out a new item and insisting on inspecting it herself before we put it away.
I'm learning so many things today,
she says, and closely inspects a clay horse figurine that must have belonged to Sid's son.
I'm glad,
I grumble, and log the toy horse that is clearly going to crack the case. By the time we finish, it's starting to get dark out, and I'm itching to get home to Prudence.
What do we do with her now?
Scully wonders out loud and looks over to the cell where the man in green has managed to scramble his way up onto the bench. Loud snoring comes from that corner of the cell.
I can take her home with me, I say and shrug. It'll be easiest for me to keep an eye on her that way, and I'm willing to cut her a deal.
This gets Marnie's attention. As long as you don't run off tonight, I will talk to the farmers tomorrow and get you those two parcels. Then you can head home and help your people. But only two parcels and no more stealing.
That's generous of you.
Jacob frowns.
I'm a generous person. My voice sounds tired. Now let's go, Marnie. I'll set you up at my place.
After laying out a bedroll beside my own bed, I make my way over to Prudence's hut. But when I enter her bedroom, I find that she is asleep.
How long has she been out?
I ask Rita quietly as she walks towards me as I'm standing in the doorway.
She's been out most of the day.
Rita gently pulls me out into the hallway and closes the door behind us.
Did you know how sick she is?
I shake my head. She didn't tell me until 2 days ago when Jacob came to get you. Rita looks pained by this.
I'm afraid Prudence doesn't have much longer to live.
When I go to open the door, she gently puts her hand on my arm.
She'll have longer if you let her rest, and right now, she's not really here anyway.
What do you mean she's not really here? The same pained expression takes over Rita's face.
Sometimes at the end, when people are this sick, they get confused. They don't know where they are. The fever, it boils their thoughts.
She will be better in the morning, but if you talk to her now, she won't make any sense. She was saying things, talking to people that weren't there, right before she fell asleep.
I see.
The urge to push down the handle and talk to Prudence is so strong it hurts. I turn around and walk out of the hut without saying a word. That night, there is no coughing from Prudence's hut. I stare at the ceiling and pray for it to come, but it never does. My weeping is the only sound in the room, other than Marnie's level breathing, until my crying wakes her up.
Are you all right?
She asks suddenly into the darkness of my bedroom.
Yes,
I say. I am deeply ashamed.
Don't tell anyone,
I add quickly.
Don't tell anyone that you are all right?
She asks. I laugh despite of myself, laughter thick with tears and snot.
She is your mother?
Marnie asks, and I don't ask her how she knows.
Yes,
I reply.
Then why does she not live in the empty room inside this hut?
Because she became my mother when my first mother left.
Your first mother left?
Yes. For a little while, Marnie doesn't say anything. But we are both awake, and so aware of each other's wakefulness that it looms large in the darkness, and so I add, she left after my father went to jail.
When?
A long time ago. I was little. And then Prudence became my mother.
I hope she gets better,
Marnie says, sleep weaving itself into her voice.
I don't think she likes that you are sad.
Soon, Marnie's breathing evens again. I turn onto my side and pray to Gara.